For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Tuesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Today we hear from Mike German, a former agent for the FBI and the author of several different books, the most recent of which is titled Policing White Supremacy, The Enemy Within. Mike German, in his work as an FBI agent, actually went undercover infiltrating several different white supremacist and far-right militias. It is there that he began to sense that not all was well with the law enforcement community, and that there were those who were strangely indifferent to the threat of white supremacy to the health of our American democracy. His concerns have only grown over the years and prompted the writing of this book published by the New Press, again, Policing White Supremacy, written by Michael German. Here is a portion of our conversation. This is where we are talking about those years in which he served as an infiltrator of white supremacy groups. This is not, of course, what we are primarily talking about today, but just for a couple moments, I want to just have our listeners get some sense of the nature of what it means to infiltrate, for instance, a white supremacy group. And what sort of skills you had to call upon in order to be, persuasive, believable as somebody subscribing to these beliefs and wanting to be a part of the activity of these groups? Or are these groups of such a nature that you can sort of easily sort of just be a figure in the background? What sort of role did you end up having to play in terms of this actual infiltration?
So as I mentioned, the case agent working on the case already had informants in place, so they introduced me as a successful criminal. I knew I couldn't pretend to be a white supremacist because I didn't know anybody in the movement. I didn't really understand the ideology as deeply as they did, so I thought that wouldn't be very fruitful. So fortunately for me as a FBI agent, they were recruiters, and you know, they're always recruiting to try to bring people into the movement, so it really isn't very hard to get them to talk to you and to try to bring you into meetings and things like that. And you know, when I talked to police officers through the rest of my career, they were always surprised that they, you know, typical criminals will not talk very much, but they try to convince anybody they meet of their ideas. The difficult part is moving away from the ideological part of the movement and identifying the people who are engaged in crime, which is a subset that acts very differently. So being presented as somebody who had been a successful criminal sort of helped bring me to the people that were actually doing things. And the rules that the FBI operated under at that time required a reasonable indication of criminal activity before I could start investigating any particular individual. So that standard, what I found was that it helped me kind of separate the wheat from the chaff, that, you know, if there were... these were Nazis. You know, everybody was saying something that was horrific and scary to me. But the requirement of writing down the evidence that made me believe these people were that these particular individuals were committing a federal crime helped me keep focused on the proper people, who often weren't the people who knew the rhetoric and spewed the invective that this, you know, that this group was a little bit different. It was a very great education in the history of white supremacy in the United States. You know, we tend to think of full-blown white supremacy as something in our history, right? This was how white people in authority thought during the pre-Civil War era, how they thought during Jim Crow and when the Black Codes were in effect, but, you know, that we're a post-racial society. But what they showed me was that the ideologies and the philosophies and the theologies that supported European colonialism, that justified the African slave trade, that justified Jim Crow, never went away. And the people who believe those ideologies and philosophies and theologies are still around, and still around, not just on the fringes of our society, but within law enforcement, within the military, within government, and their connection to the violent fringe isn't as attenuated as many people think.
Right. It's not. And, they are not as peripheral a presence in American life as we might imagine, or maybe as has sometimes been the case. And I think your book makes a stunning statement, one of many, but this one in particular was something that I had certainly never stopped to consider, and that is the actual origin of the Justice Department itself, under which, of course, agencies like the FBI operate. And you tell us that, in fact, well, these are your words, federal law enforcement's mandate to address white supremacist violence dates back to the 1870s, when Congress passed the act to establish the Department of Justice. The first task of this new federal body was to address violence by groups who opposed the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments, which granted citizenship and civil rights protections to formerly enslaved African Americans. This is one reason why I think you are very disturbed and believe all Americans should be very disturbed when the Department of Justice, in one way or another, fails in this responsibility, because it is at the heart of why the Department of Justice was created in the first place back in the 19th century.
That's exactly right, Ed. And that it was effective, right? The groups, you know, most infamously the Ku Klux Klan, that were running roughshod over the newly emancipated people in the South, were suppressed by this new law, and were basically they put out of business. Prosecutions were successful, and in fact it was so successful that the Supreme Court started chipping away at those laws almost, you know, very quickly, and started, you know, limiting how law enforcement could do that as Reconstruction ended, and Jim Crow was white, you know, lawful white, you know, white supremacy in law was restored through the Jim Crow laws and Black Codes. So, you know, knowing that there is a successful model and that those statutes remain on the books, right? Our civil rights laws have their basis in those 1870 statutes, and you know, there was Charleston, South Carolina mass shooting at a AME church by a white supremacist, that there was this narrative that a lot of former Justice Department and FBI officials were pushing, that, oh, the reason why the FBI and Justice Department are not very effective in policing white supremacist violence is because we don't have a domestic terrorism law. And that immediately hit me as an absurd notion, since I had worked domestic terrorism cases in the 1990s as an FBI agent, and none of the prosecutors suggested we didn't have enough lawful authority to investigate those cases, which were very successful. So it was kind of an odd argument to make. So I started writing reports from the Brennan Center to identify all the laws. There's actually a whole chapter in the U.S. Criminal Code called terrorism, right? So it's an absurd notion that the lack of attention to these crimes is due to a lack of authority. It's that they ignore the authorities that they have.
Right. And it is a matter of, in a sense, misplaced priorities. In fact, there's a very interesting statistic that you give at one point in the book in which you are talking about, I think, the U.S. Criminal Code, maybe, and the fact that in the section devoted to terrorism and terrorist acts, that there are 57 different sort of categories or components or elements. And
they're actually called federal crimes of terrorism, so there's no ambiguity about
Yes. And of those 57, 51 of them involve domestic terrorism versus international terrorism. And it is your contention that one of the problems here is that the FBI, for a variety of reasons perhaps, is choosing to focus much more of its attention than is warranted on matters other than, for instance, domestic terrorism done by white supremacy groups, that is not receiving the attention and resources are not being appropriately devoted to attack that. And part of your book is to try to explain why that is.
That's right. In the early part of the 2000s, the FBI would publicly state that the number one domestic terrorism threat was eco-terrorism from environmental groups and animal rights groups, which is absurd because there's no examples of deadly violence being used by environmental activists. You know, certainly you could point to some cases of arson, isolated property damage, but compared to the white supremacist violence that regularly kills people in the United States, and in particular regularly kills police officers, I mean, that's one of the frustrations for me as a former law enforcement officer, that this timidity around investigating and prosecuting white supremacist violence it impacts police themselves, that they're often the victims, as we saw on January 6th.
Mm. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Michael German about his latest book, Policing White Supremacy, published by The New Press, with the subtitle The Enemy Within. Michael German is a former special agent of the FBI, and so he is writing from a very special sort of position of expertise and experience. In the first section of the book, which is titled From the Shadows to the Spotlight, you explain some of the ways in which some of these white supremacy groups and far-right militants operate in a fashion very differently than was once the case. And maybe we should take just a moment to address this matter of terminology and the fact that you are sometimes talking about white supremacists, sometimes talking about far-right militias and other terms. How interchangeable are these terms? And is it important for us to be cautious and precise in using them?
So the white supremacist movement and the far-right militant movement are very fractured. There are a lot, you know, again, you have to look back and see that these are ideas that have, you know, that justified European colonialism, that justified the African slave trade, have been around for a long time. So there are lots of different strains of ideas. Some have a foundation in religion. So there's a diversity of opinion, even though their bottom line is that there is a racial hierarchy with white people at the top. They often have very different ideas that get them there. So they're often warring with each other over, you know, as I said, they're recruiters, so they're all trying to get members. They're when they're involved in crime, they're the subject of police attention, so they're trying to hide their true intentions in many cases. So it's a very paranoid and really talking about when I was undercover in the 90s, fractious group. So, you know, a lot of researchers will look at a particular element within the movement. And some of these elements are openly white supremacists, neo-Nazis, neo-Confederates, where others of them pretend not to be, and will often focus on targeting a particular group. They're either an anti-Muslim group or anti-Semitic group, but they'll deny being racist overall. Some groups are entirely political and really don't promote racism, but when they're in the streets committing violence, it's often shoulder to shoulder with white supremacists in a common cause. For the purposes of law enforcement, it's you know, somebody going undercover might need to know those striations through the movement, but law enforcement in general, it helps to understand it as a whole, as a movement, rather than trying to separate all these different elements that create a lot of confusion. And particularly in writing a book, as I did, one of the ways these groups benefit from that discussion about who's a white supremacist, what my beliefs are, is they know that most people might find these ideas odious, there will be enough people that say, oh, those ideas are interesting. So the fine discussion of the various ideologies within it is often a recruiting benefit for them. I take it from a law enforcement perspective to understand how both the federal government and state and local police often don't understand that these groups are operating in networks. And, you know, that's what makes it hard because, you know, as you mentioned, I criticize the FBI's lack of attention to the problem. But if you're a police officer in some small town in Illinois and you have a hate crime or a white supremacist murder or a militia group that's engaged in some kind of mayhem, you might not know that across the state line they committed other crimes, and that, you know, the people that you're arresting were actually at an event in a different state, and that's why it requires a national perspective and frankly even an international perspective. Kind of one of the pieces of evidence for this for the government's looking at white supremacy as a benign thing is that they don't recognize that they call it domestic terrorism, where white supremacy has never been entirely domestic, right? There are a lot of white supremacists in Europe, and these groups often communicate, network, share ideas. So in the FBI's program, they separate international terrorism from domestic terrorism, with international terrorism getting 80% of the resources and domestic terrorism only getting 20%. And then, as you said, that 20% doesn't go all to white supremacy. It goes to animal rights activists. It goes to surveillance programs targeting black activists. It goes to a number of different categories that they've divided their program into, rather than focusing on the most violent threat, which is by far the white supremacists and far-right militaries, their militias.
When you talk about the incident that occurred in Charlottesville back in August of 2017 and what was widely regarded as a deficient police response to those events, you pose an interesting question. If law enforcement leaders knew the white supremacist rally was likely to result in violence, Why did they adopt and maintain a passive approach that allowed that violence to occur and the perpetrators to escape without identification or arrest? Timely and accurate intelligence is worthless if it does not compel law enforcement officials to take the actions necessary to mitigate the threat. You end this paragraph by saying the reviews indicate how the intelligence had been analyzed through a biased prism. That's an interesting choice of words. And I suspect that that biased prism is something that is in place in many places under many different circumstances where information is coming in, but if it is interpreted in a certain way through a so-called biased prism, then choices are going to be made in terms of the nature of the response or if there's going to be a significant response at all. And that is a very dangerous threat that your book is trying to highlight.
Yeah, and I'll bring up one salient example. In 2020, I wrote a report called Hidden in Plain Sight for the Brennan Center that focused specifically on racism, white supremacy, and far-right militancy in law enforcement. And Representative Jamie Raskin held a hearing at the House Oversight Committee where to look at that problem. And my report focused on internal FBI documents, and they matched what I had been warned when I was an agent, but there was a 2006 document that had been released through somebody's Freedom of Information Act request that described white supremacist infiltration of law enforcement. And it posed it as a problem for the FBI, both the safety of the agents, but also the integrity of their investigations, that they had to be careful about sharing information about investigations of white supremacists because there was a potential that law enforcement sympathizers would share that information with the groups under investigation. In 2015, the FBI published, they didn't publish, this was an internal document that was later leaked, an FBI counterterrorism field guide. And this guide instructed agents investigating domestic terrorism investigations of white supremacists and far-right militias that the subjects of their investigations, the people that they're investigating for domestic terrorism crimes, will often have active links to law enforcement. And then it instructs them to alter their tactics in a way that would mask their investigation from other law enforcement agencies. So to my mind, if the FBI is judging this problem significant enough to alter their own techniques and warn their agents, it's shocking that they don't have a strategy to protect the public from these white supremacists and far-right militants in law enforcement. But at the hearing, Jamie Raskin wanted the FBI to come in, update the intelligence that they had in this 2006 and 2015 documents, and testify at the hearing. Instead, the FBI disavowed the intelligence, the previous intelligence, said they did not see white supremacist infiltration of law enforcement as a problem, and refused to testify. And that was 3 months before the January 6th attack, when about more than two dozen police officers were involved in assaulting the Capitol, attacking police officers, attacking police officers in that event. So it sort of shows how the bias would allow FBI managers to disavow intelligence their own agents had collected and reported up the chain. And I believe the only explanation is that their own biases don't let them believe what their agents and analysts are telling them. Right. And it turned out later that there were other internal reports within the FBI warning both specifically about the January 6th attack, but about the problem of white supremacy and far-right militancy and law enforcement as well.
If I read your book correctly, it seems to me you are talking about a couple of different possibilities that are not exactly the same, but both are deeply concerning. One is that one is a more benign possibility, which is that that there are certain people where their that biased prism is simply one of just somehow not grasping the seriousness of this white supremacy activity when compared to, for instance, the activity of Al-Qaeda, and just somehow a disbelief that it can possibly be as serious or as much a cause for concern versus out-and-out racism. I mean, racist attitudes, an outright sympathy for the mindset of, for instance, white supremacists. And it seems to me that you are touching in your book on both of those possibilities. Is that right?
Absolutely. You know, it's all of the above, from people who are just willfully blind, from people who are just enforcing institutional policies that were created in an earlier generation and haven't really been updated. I mean, you've got to remember the FBI in particular is still predominantly white and predominantly male. It's almost 80% white and about 75% male. So, you know, a lot of that is just the attitudes that demographic has. But, you know, the FBI has an institutional history of viewing political organizing by marginalized groups as a national security threat and ignoring violence and even deadly violence by white supremacists and treating it, when they look at it at all, as a local police problem rather than a federal issue. You know, and again, another example is Congress obviously has been attuned because they're responsive to the public concern about hate crimes. And Congress passed 5 federal hate crime statutes that the Justice Department and FBI can work with. The Justice Department, every couple of years, does what they call a National Crime Victim Survey. This is a research branch of the Department of Justice that does this. And in these surveys, victims of crime report approximately 230,000 violent hate crimes a year occur in the country. The FBI and Justice Department, with 5 federal hate crime statutes, prosecute about 50 defendants out of 230,000 possible hate crimes. So it just shows that there's not an interest in actually pursuing this on a national basis at a scale at which the crimes are occurring.
Right.
And, you know, often these crimes, hate crimes, target the same communities that are over-policed by law enforcement. Mm. So, you know, these communities are over-policed as potential crime suspects, but under-protected as victims of crime.
Right. And that is a point you make again and again in your book. We are talking with Michael German about his new book, Policing White Supremacy, The Enemy Within. At one point in talking about the activity of some of these groups, and particularly the way in which they have altered their tactics in recent years, we actually see the word coy, C-O-Y. And it's a really intriguing adjective because I think most of us who are horrified by such groups and what they do and what they believe would never think of a term like coy to describe what they do and how they go about doing it. And yet there really are a number of ways in which white supremacist groups have learned to be more coy and then thus more successful, not only in recruitment of members, but also in terms of the way in which they are perceived by law enforcement agencies like the FBI. And one of the ways that you tell us this has occurred is in the way in which the far right has been using more and more rallies and marches that give a certain impression of what they are all about. Tell us more about that.
Sure. Well, what we saw, excuse me, what we saw often during the first Trump term was white supremacists and far-right militants coming out in public demonstrations, often oppositional to some local group. And They would make the argument exercising our First Amendment rights, we're just expressing ourselves, and police would take that into account and treat people who the white supremacists clashed with as the perpetrators. But this is a time-worn tactic. This is what the Nazi Party in Germany did at its formation, and the idea is they know that they have political opposition who are offended by their rhetoric, so they target those communities, and they'll bring people from outside those communities in, usually armed, equipped, ready for a fight, hoping to bring out political opposition that they can then attack and facetiously claim they were just exercising their rights and engaging in self-defense. But in the 1990s, law enforcement understood that. They understood what they were doing. And, when these demonstrations would have, they would take natural precautions to make sure, number one, people with active warrants for previous criminal attacks are not coming into town, that people who have a history of violence are being watched specifically because there's an understanding that we know this person isn't here to express himself. He's here to commit an act of violence, and we want to be on top of it. I mean, I was surprised during the violence at the Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville in 2017 that law enforcement hadn't prepared for it and wasn't preventing the violence that was occurring. But because most of it was being live streamed, I was watching it from my living room in New York City. Now there's all this evidence, and I was assumed that, okay, law enforcement had failed to protect the community in that day, but now they have all this evidence of all these people committing crimes. They'll wrap all these people up, but we didn't see that. In fact, law enforcement was very slow to start investigating, and really only started investigating after members of the public had identified people. Look, here's an image of this person. Here's his name. Here's where he lives. Here's the crime he's committing. ProPublica ran a series focusing on one particular group, the Rise Above movement, that had traveled all the way from California to Charlottesville to engage in this kind of violence. And they had been engaging in violence at rallies all across California prior to that. So, again, it's a matter of the police not understanding this is a tactic for committing violence against their political enemies, and they tend to not really understand what the purpose of this tactic is. And you use the word coy, and it's that way both in real life when they're out on the street, but particularly online, where one of the things that they will do is and particularly the groups that claim that they're not racist, they will put out some provocative racist statement or action in kind of a snarky way, where when people get upset about it, they'll say, oh, I'm just joking. It's just joking. You're too sensitive. But that serves a purpose of desensitizing people to that rhetoric, to making it make people think it's just a fun joke rather than something that can recruit people with ill intent to engage in violent criminal activity.
By the way, as at one point when you are talking about these various groups and the way in which sometimes they are taken together rather fractious, not often perfectly aligning with one another in terms of intention or whatever. But as you are discussing kind of that complicated picture, you do say at one point, white supremacist and far-right militant groups, despite their menace, are actually small in number. And you go on to say, so they often welcome any support they can get, even if the person offering assistance does not neatly fit into a strict interpretation of their ideology. I mean, it's a relief to read that we're actually talking about a relatively small number of people within the whole framework of the population, but nevertheless, they are absolutely a menace. I mean, a terrible menace in many, many respects. But I just wanted to take a moment to kind of acknowledge that fact, because it's very easy to read a book like this and, through no fault of your own, more of kind of the way we tend to react emotionally to things, it's really easy to start to feel like down every city block, around every single corner, is another white supremacist. I mean, that they are everywhere. And it's kind of hard to kind of gauge the way in which we should properly take all of this in, and the way in which we should think about what you really regard as a menace to our democracy, even if the actual number of people we're talking about is maybe more modest than we might sort of emotionally interpret it to be.
That's right. And that weakness, I think, is something that isn't properly exploited by law enforcement, particularly. And you know, could be more effective if they simply focused on the crimes. You know, part of the problem is in a post-9/11 counterterrorism era, they resurrected this theory of radicalization that was the same theory that J. Edgar Hoover used to justify targeting the civil rights movement and anti-war movement in the 1950s, 60s, and 70s. And the idea was that it wasn't just the relative handful of people who are committing crimes and acts of violence that are the problem. It's everyone who shares similar ideology, or anyone who is associated with anyone who shares the ideology, and it kept making these circles bigger and bigger, and you know, wrapping up more and more people who were not actually doing anything to commit any harm, and making them suspects as well. And that both distracted the investigators and gave some justification to the conspiracy theory the violent element was pushing, that hey, we're being targeted by our government, we are the victims, so you know, we have to fight this oppression, so come join with us to fight. You know, it made that seem real, that oh, wait a minute, you know, here are people who aren't doing anything wrong who believe these things, who are being targeted, so what's the point of staying on the right side of the law if the law is going to come after you anyway? So it helps them recruit more. Moreover, once in, again, during the first term where these groups felt that they were being authorized to come out in public and commit violence, the lack of policing of those of that public violence attracted a much more violent element. So, you know, again, a lot of the people in these cases tend to have histories of crime and violent crime. And, you know, they would see that, oh, you know, if I commit the kind of crimes that I've been committing, I might get caught and arrested. But I can go out in public with this group and beat people up and walk by and, you know, in some cases, fist bump a police officer who will let me leave town. So, you know, that authorization, or that tacit authorization to commit this violence, makes them much, much more dangerous, particularly when there are people in a position of authority in either state, local, or federal government who seem to be giving them that kind of authority that, you know, then it's very easy to bring lots of people into a mob action.
Right.
Because they think that they're authority figure is asking them to do that. And of course, we saw that with a lot of the January 6th defendants, that they felt like they were being asked to do something by the President of the United States.
Right. In the second part of your book, which is titled A Strategy for Change, you outline a lot of different ways in which the FBI and other agencies in law enforcement need to rethink the way they meet this threat. And some of that has to do with things as seemingly mundane as categorization. And yet that really is an important driver of how certain decisions are made. In fact, you say at one point, the first step in a national strategy is to change the way the government documents and shares data on racist and far-right violence. I mean, that is that is the thing of paperwork and people sitting at desks, you know, not the kind of FBI work we see in the movies, for instance. But, I mean, you see this as of enormous importance.
Yeah, absolutely. The FBI divides its domestic terrorism program into a number of different ideological categories. So there, when I was working undercover, there was a category for white supremacy, a category for what they then called black separatist violence that referred to the Black Panthers and the Black Liberation Army of the 1970s type of violence, environmentalists, animal rights activists, anti-abortion activists, and so on. But you know, when you create a category, that demands resources, right? And what they haven't done and have refused to do, despite Congress passing a law demanding that they do it, is collect data about the number of domestic terrorism incidents that occur in the country and which category is involved. Because, you know, if you look at what private researchers and activists have gathered, the data, white supremacists are by far more active and more deadly than any of these categories, some of which it'd be very rare to find any deadly act over decades, where white supremacists kill people each year in and out. And what the law Congress passed did was ask them to present both sides of the ledger. So the number of incidents, the number of fatalities resulting from those incidents for each category, and then on the other side, the number of investigations the FBI opened, the number of indictments and convictions. And that way you could analyze the program that, you know, here's a category with lots of mayhem and murder, but a relatively fewer investigations. Here's a category where they really can't find any deadly violence coming from it, and yet they have investigations, right? It doesn't make any sense. It wouldn't make any sense. But the FBI has refused to provide that data and actually says in their documents that they don't collect domestic terrorism data. That they don't know how many domestic terrorist incidents happened in the country. They don't know how many people have been killed by that, which is astonishing to think of when the FBI counts counterterrorism as its number one mission, right? But I believe that the reason they resist this, and they've done other things to resist it. One of the things they did was collapse the categories so that white supremacists and what they then called black identity extremists were in one category. Well, I know from my in undercover work that it's pretty rare for a white supremacist group to work with a black identity extremist group, if that such ideology even exists.
And you're talking really there about in a sense the creation of a false equivalence, which leads to some really really bad decisions being made about about how resources and are utilized and where attention is given. You also talk at one point too much information is as serious an impediment to effective intelligence analysis as too little. So it cannot just be about gathering as much information as we possibly can, but understanding where the real threats are and seeking out information in a more thoughtful way. That's maybe one aspect of something that is maybe one of the most intriguing lines in the entire book, when you say Congress must proceed with caution in the face of proposals to expand the Bureau's investigative authorities. To prevent far-right violence effectively, the FBI needs narrower powers, not broader ones. It's really important for us to think carefully about that.
Right. And so the audience understands the FBI's investigative authorities expanded significantly after 9/11, and that reasonable indication of criminal activity standard that I worked under in the 1990s was erased. And now FBI agents can open investigations even without a supervisor's approval, without any evidence that a person has done anything wrong. They can use recruit and deploy informants into a group that you might be active with. They can use subpoenas to gather information about your communications accounts. They can do physical surveillance, all these very intrusive tools to target people that they don't have any factual basis to believe are doing anything wrong. And when they got this authority in 2008, the New York Times obtained some data from the FBI that they opened 82,000 of these cases in the first 2 years. They're called assessments. And you know, the 82,000 over 2 years might not sound like a lot, but you should consider that there are only 12,000 FBI special agents. So that gives you a sense of how much of the FBI's investigative resources were going to investigations that were not targeting people where they had some specific evidence that they were doing anything wrong. And all that collection authority just fills FBI databases that are used to do things like put people on a terrorist watch list, which is why the watch list expanded out of control and is so bloated that that the police officers are often in a position where so many people are being stopped, but they're not really terrorists. They're not doing anything wrong. And you know, they just have to let them go, which again makes law enforcement think that this is all a big joke and not take these terrorist watch list hits seriously.
Right. Yeah, it becomes a point where it becomes not only largely useless, but even counterproductive. Well, a final go ahead.
One point to highlight that, the Washington Post reported after January 6th that there were dozens of people on the terrorist watch list that had come to Washington that day. So you would think that a counterterrorism agency seeing dozens of people that they had labeled terrorists coming to Washington, D.C. for this rally, they would have realized that, oh, this is going to be a significant event. But again, I think that the excesses in that process have created a chilling effect where people just don't think that a terrorism watch list hit is meaningful.
Right. So that a refinement of that practice and a better understanding of that is among a number of suggestions you make. A last quick question. We are having this conversation not long after President Trump announced the pardon of those involved in the events of January 6th. I wonder what the news of that does to you in terms of your understanding of all this, your concerns about all this, and your belief in terms of what must be done in the future to remedy this.
So it certainly sends a message to these far-right militant groups that if you commit violence that Donald Trump approves of, you'll be protected. It also sends a very clear message to law enforcement that if you investigate these groups, that's going to be a fruitless endeavor. And what we're seeing with the attempt to identify all the FBI agents who worked on these cases, it potentially even get you in trouble if you work these kinds of cases. So it's I think it's more about messaging, but the problem is once you give the green light to political violence, it's very hard to predict how that violence is going to manifest. And so I think there's going to be violence that doesn't necessarily target who, looking at it as a mainstream audience, you might see as their enemies, right? That, you know, a lot of these groups are not Donald Trump fans. They're not fans of Republican politics. I think we're in for a very different type of violence than what we've seen in the past.
Mm-hmm. Well, I appreciate all that your book explores, and it, needless to say, gives us a lot to think about. The book is Policing White Supremacy, The Enemy Within, published by New Press, the author, Mike German. Tomorrow on The Morning Show, Ron Kronovich, professor of economics at Carthage College. He will soon be serving as a moderator for an event at Carthage that explores the affordable housing shortage here in southeastern Wisconsin. That's tomorrow on The Morning Show. Today it's going to be sunny, breezy, and bitterly cold with a high of just 10 above and wind chills at some points down to 29 below. Partly cloudy overnight, a low of 4 below, and wind chills 20 below. By tomorrow, cloudy skies, a high of 13 degrees. By Thursday, a high of 23. And we should actually be into the upper 30s for a high by Sunday. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva.